World. I'm John Batchelor, joined by Jonathan Schanzer, Vice President of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, looking at the headlines around the Gaza conflict. I start in the Times of Israel, which is echoed in the London Times reporting in these last hours. Netanyahu says Rafah offensive will go ahead with or without hostage deal. Subhead, Hamas set to respond to proposals said to include 40-day truce, release of almost 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for 20 to 30 hostages. PM, war won't end until all goals achieved. I mention that the foreign minister of the United Kingdom, Mr. Cameron, is on record saying this is a very generous offer. And, Jonathan, a very good evening to you. Thank you for joining. The fact of the matter is Hamas is in a corner of the Gaza Strip, we're told, and that the Rafah operation describes, as you did last week, clearing out of the migrants from the north and center of Gaza, moving them back to the center and north, as I understand it, very small space, in something like a tent city, and then launching the operation against Rafah. Has that changed in the week since we talked, Jonathan? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Noah, from what we can pick up from the Israelis, they are gathering ahead of steam here. They seem to have a plan. They seem to be ready to execute on it. They have been moving some of the displaced persons to the coast further north of Rafah. In fact, they've even targeted a few Hamas entities or individuals within the area of Rafah. So what we're watching right now is an Israeli military that is softening the ground, preparing for this ultimate invasion of Rafah. And it will be the last major combat operation from what we understand. There will almost certainly be some kind of an insurgency that remains, but the Israelis have prepared for that as well. So now the real question is, at what point do the Israelis just move in? Because they've been offered a deal by the U.S., brokered by the U.S., as well as the Qataris and the Egyptians. It's been floated to Hamas. We understand right now that it would be an extended ceasefire in exchange for roughly 30 hostages. That's down from 60. It's down from 40. The Israelis continue to make concessions on this front. As a means, I think, to show goodwill with the U.S., with the U.K., with the international community. From what we hear right now, Hamas is not taking this deal, and that will likely herald a more rapid pace here in terms of an Israeli invasion of this last bastion, this last holdout of Hamas in Rafah.
When we spoke over these last weeks, there's always been the question about exits from Rafah underground into the Sinai. Do we have any clarity about that? And that brings in the Egyptian opinion of this. Do the Egyptians want the Israelis crossing into Sinai in order to secure or in some fashion defeat Hamas?
So this, I have to say, John, is one of the murkier angles of this entire war. For many years, the Egyptians were identified as partners with the Israelis in terms of sidelining Hamas. They always came in to try to broker calm after hostilities broke out. We saw that in the last war in 2021. We saw it before that in 2014. And now all of a sudden, we're picking up indications that they may have allowed for very large tunnels to operate below the ground in what's known as the Philadelphia Corridor. This is a small area. It is the border between Gaza and Sinai. And from what I'm picking up right now, the Egyptians are complicit in some way. And this probably explains why they are so opposed to the Israelis operating in and around Rafah. I think the Israelis are going to have to be very careful about crossing over, whether underground or above ground, but they are going to have to deal with this because ultimately they are going to need to pivot away from Egypt as a place for the distribution of aid, of international aid. We now know that the Cypriots have actually prepared for a steady supply of assistance, humanitarian aid that would be actually shipped in a maritime route. It's about 200 nautical miles between Cyprus and Gaza. It would be monitored by the Israelis. It would be monitored by the Americans. And this, in my view, is probably the best way to make sure that aid continues to flow. Egypt, I think, will be moved out of this process. But in the meantime, we can see them raising quite a stink about the possibility, just the possibility of Israel entering Rafah. I think it's because they are concerned about how this will make the Sisi regime look once those tunnels are found and exposed.
You mentioned Cyprus. It's a divided island. And that brings in Erdogan and his intentions. There was a photograph a week ago of Erdogan shaking hands with Haniyeh, the head of Hamas, or at least the political head of Hamas. And I believe they were in Turkey at the time. And there was talk about offering Hamas, in some fashion, sanctuary outside of Istanbul. Since then, the mayor of Istanbul has denounced Hamas as a terrorist organization. Do we have clarity where that conversation is? And is Hamas looking at Turkey as refuge, the way the PLO used the North African ports as refuge back in the 80s?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes. We know already that Istanbul is a major headquarters for Hamas. There are a handful of others out there. Of course, the country of Qatar is one place where the leadership has been based. There are some in Lebanon, although they are endangered species, as we have now seen, because the Israelis really have no reservations about taking out individuals in their cars or in their homes in Lebanon right now. The war is actually heating up there. But in Turkey, they have actually enjoyed something of a safe haven because the Israelis would never dare attack Istanbul, at least not yet. But we can see that there is probably about 100 different people that are based there. There already is a headquarters. So the question is, you know, if Hamas is forced out of Gaza and there is something that looks like what happened in Lebanon in the early 80s when the Israelis pushed out the PLO and they moved to Tunisia, and they all left by boat. The question is, would that happen again here in a public way where Hamas would declare itself to be now based in Turkey? That remains to be seen, but there are a few other options. The Qataris are getting a bit wobbly, a bit weak in the knees about how that looks to the international community. Erdogan does not seem to care. He actually just tried to send a flotilla. If you remember the previous one from 2010 that led to a clash on the high seas between Turkish jihadists and Israeli commandos, they tried to do that again. They were thwarted. It appears that the insurance companies would not support a couple of these ships going, and so they've stood down. And as it happens, Erdogan was supposed to be in Washington meeting at the White House on May 9th. And he apparently has now canceled that trip. It's unclear whether these are all related, but Erdogan is certainly not behaving like a NATO ally.
Therefore, we come to where we are in the Hamas war, knowing that Hezbollah remains a huge problem in the north. There have been responses by the IAF over these last days to Hezbollah peppering the northern frontier. Is that matter set aside for now, Jonathan, all eyes on Hamas? Or the last time we talked, the presumption was something must be done, but nothing of major consequence has. Has there been any change about the thinking in the north?
I continue to keep an eye on the north. Every day, that is the first thing that I think about. As much as I think the action in Rafah or what's happening in Egypt or even what's happening on our college campuses right now appear to be dominating the headlines, this is the big war because Hezbollah remains a very powerful player, 200,000 rockets, advanced weaponry. If and when these two sides decide to go to war, it will have major ramifications for the Middle East. And right now, everyone that I talk to in the region is saying that it's 50-50. in terms of whether a war breaks out in the north. It could be higher than that, according to folks that I've talked to, because the Israelis are running out of patience. There have been 100,000 people evacuated from their northern communities. It's essentially a DMZ right now that is in Israeli territory. And that is not something that the Israeli public is willing to put up with. And you do get a sense that Hezbollah is possibly bruising for a fight here, too. So we continue to watch that tension. It is still something that is very possible that a war could occur. A lot of different things to watch in the region right now.
The politics. You mentioned, as we touched upon Hamas, that it was a U.S. brokered deal. The hostages, the Palestinian prisoners for, what did you say, 20 or 30? 30 hostages at most. And there's a photograph of a man looking extremely ill, said to be a hostage. In any event, the White House brokered that as a bridge, as a demand. How is the conversation between Jerusalem and Washington now? Is Washington willing to accept that Rafah is dug in and will die in place?
It's funny, the rhetoric changes from, it's almost daily right now. Right now the U.S. is very clearly pushing for a deal to be struck. They want to see the return of, I'm guessing probably about half of the hostages that are still alive. I've heard that there are about 60 that are still with us now. So getting half of them back would, I think, really be an important thing for the Israeli public. At one point after the attack by Iran against Israel, the Biden administration and David Cameron and others were saying, don't attack Iran. Let's go back to Rafah. Let's start talking about Gaza. In other words, trying to keep Israel from escalating into something that would look like a regional war. Now that the Israelis are preparing their plans for a Rafah invasion, we're hearing from the White House that they are opposed to such an invasion right now, that they would rather focus on the diplomacy. So we continue to see the White House speak out of both sides of its mouth. One day, by the way, funding Israel's war efforts, the next day slamming the Israeli government or talking about issuing sanctions. The messaging has been clear as mud from the White House over the last several months, really since our election season heated up here in the United States. Somewhere around January or February, the president went from a full-throated supporter of the Israeli war effort to a 50% critic, 50% supporter. And that just changes. The ratio changes almost daily.
And finally, the concern also in the White House and in Washington and New York headlines is that the Israeli cabinet is divided in some fashion, and that when Netanyahu departs, this is theoretical, all will be well. I have not read anything in the Israeli English language papers that suggests that the cabinet is anything but monolithic, certain, all ready for the Rafah operation. Has that changed, John?
I don't think it's changed. I think that the war cabinet, the three individuals that are making the primary decisions, they appear to have a plan and they appear ready to do it. I think some are listening to U.S. warnings a bit more closely than others. But I do pick up that politically there is one interesting thing to watch, which is that if Netanyahu does move forward with a deal that releases those 30 hostages and postpones the Rafah operation, he may see the collapse of his government, because two of the right-wing ministers are saying that such a deal is not advantageous to Israel and that they need to move forward with the Gaza operation. They need to finish their war. So we see some tension that Benjamin Netanyahu is forced to deal with here. How he chooses to move forward remains to be seen.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Shanzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, focusing on the war fighting. But there's trouble in the United States to do with anti-Semitism when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.